Did you know that most vitamin D3 supplements come from sheep's wool? I'm Kat, founder of Ritual. We're making traceability the new standard for the supplement industry. When I was pregnant, I couldn't find a multivitamin I could trust, so I created my own. Ours is made traceable, third-party tested, and clean label project certified. Oh, and our vitamin D3? It comes from sustainably harvested lichen from England, not sheep. Trace for yourself with 25% off at ritual.com/podcast.
Welcome to the Franziska Show podcast on jewishcoffeehouse.com, the show where I give a voice to Jewish issues, topics, and people. I'm Franziska Frady, your host.
Before we begin, I'd like to send our deepest condolences to Rav Scott Kahn, the host of Orthodox Conundrum and Intimate Judaism. His father passed away this morning. It is with great sadness that I announce this to you today. In preparation for Pesach, I was inspired to share a second episode for this week, especially for those of you who will be complaining that over Pesach, I will be sharing a replay of an episode. If you have suggestions of a replay episode, please do message me. As of today's episode, let me give you a little background. A long time ago, I think it was Erev Rosh Hashanah, I released an episode with a therapist talking about narcissistic parents. I'll link it for you in the show notes. It's called Healing from a Narcissistic Parent with Esther Moskowitz. I asked for volunteers to come on and talk about their personal experiences, and someone did reach out to me and asked to be interviewed. And we scheduled the episode, and then the war broke out, and then we postponed the episode, but then we recorded it anyway. Now, finally, we're getting closer to a relevant time, holidays, and I think it can be a helpful episode to listen to. So I'm putting it out there for you. And as always, thank you for suggesting topics. Thank you for volunteering to share on these topics. Here we go.
Welcome, Franstans, to the Franziska Show. Today, we have a volunteer with us who is willing to share her experience with a parental figure. We'll find out more soon. Who is a narcissist, and we'll hear firsthand of what it's like, what we need to know, and we'll get started with that. So welcome, Miriam. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
First, you could tell us who this person is in your life.
This is my mother-in-law. My husband and I have been married for about 15 years. So I've had 15 years of experience with my in-laws, and have cultivated a arsenal of tools and experiences that over these 15 years that have led me to reach out and say, hey, maybe I can share this with other people who might benefit.
So tell us a little bit about yourself, your religious and professional background, so we know what kind of Jew we're listening to.
I am an Orthodox Jew. I was raised in an Orthodox Jewish community. My parents are Bali Tshuva, so they did not grow up religious. They grew up more traditional, like observed holidays, but not necessarily Shabbat in their home every week. They became religious in college. They went to the same school, and Chabad rabbi on campus introduced them, and they were still evolving in their religious journey. When I was a little kid, I went to Beis Yaakov type schools. It's elementary and high school. And then I went to post-high school and Jewish education seminary. And then I went to college and grad school. I studied the sciences, and I've worked in healthcare for the past 15, 17 years, something like that.
Tell us how your journey with your in-laws begins. At what point do you meet them in your relationship with your husband?
So my husband and I had been dating for about 2 months or so when I first met his parents. And I remember driving up to their house with him and thinking, wow, this is a fancy house. There's luxury cars in the driveway. I'm like, God, this is something I don't know from. And I was a little bit intimidated, and like they had all this artwork in their house. And I was like, wow, these people must be really rich. I did not grow up in a family with much means. What is this going to be like? And what struck me as odd is when he and I were talking about finances, because that's something you do when you're dating seriously, I never got the sense that his parents were well-to-do, just like kind of middle of the road. And yet there was all this really fancy stuff. And I was like, okay, that seems a bit interesting. Only years later, when they were declaring bankruptcy, did I learn that they couldn't afford any of this stuff. And it was one of the first thing, well, the first thing that I saw, but it was one of the first ways that I noticed something didn't match up between the desire to have lots of stuff that indicates that you're well-to-do, but not being able to afford it. Like there was a mismatch between the reality and the perceived.
Was your husband aware of that dissonance, or was he naive and young?
No, he was definitely not naive. And he has made lots of decisions in his life that in retrospect seem to be based off of seeing what his parents, shall we say, poor financial decisions have been. He chose a career in finance. He's very conservative financially, which is why he and I got along very well, and not a big risk taker, not overextending. And that was, in retrospect, seems to be like a reaction to the way he saw his parents live.
And the desire for keeping up with the Joneses, or maybe it's just wanting to be above everyone. Yeah, go ahead.
It's a desire for surrounding yourself with things of high value to indicate to others that you're worth a lot. So another example of this would be when my in-laws were moving from one home to another, they needed to update their homeowner's insurance policy. And because they had all this, what we were told was very valuable things, my husband suggested that they get the various items appraised to include their value in the homeowner's insurance policy so that they would be covered in case of, you know, natural disaster, theft, whatever. So I had just so happened to recently helped my mom with getting some stuff of my grandmother's appraised. So I had like all of this, all of these resources, and passed them on to my mother-in-law, said like, this is the agency we use. This is, you know, how I did it. And you know, later my husband asked, oh, mom, did you ever follow up? She's like, no, I know that they're valuable. I know that this painting is worth $50,000. I know that this jewelry is very expensive. I don't need someone to tell me that it's expensive. So at that point I was like, a painting worth $50,000 and you're not going to get it insured? That doesn't make any sense. So I started researching the painting. I found it on eBay, had recently sold for less than $1,000. So there's like this huge disconnect between perceived and real value. And as long as something is perceived to be valuable, that makes her feel more valuable. And there have been numerous examples of this over and over, but that's one.
Give us some more examples.
So the cars, that was another thing. Even when literally they were declaring bankruptcy, she went out and bought a luxury car because cars don't get repossessed immediately in bankruptcy filings. I did not know that, but at least at that time for their situation, it wasn't going to be repossessed because it was considered important for work purposes, which, you know, I kind of get. So they're filing bankruptcy and she goes and buys a Lexus. There's a total disconnect between what is appropriate, what you can afford, and that desire, like people have to see me drive a Lexus because then they'll think that I'm worth more.
Can I ask what industry she works in?
She worked in real estate for a while. She also worked in different things at different times. I got the sense from other family members that she kind of did things for a short amount of time. And when she wasn't particularly successful in it, she like changed. So she had a secretarial service for a while. She, like I said, worked in real estate. She did home renovation design when it was, you know, when there were a lot of homes in their area being sold that needed to be redone. She kind of got into that with some of her same real estate clients. And I mean, mediocre, but not like, you know, top tier, the one everybody is running to by her own admission. It was interesting. She mentioned something late. It's like, oh, wow, that's the first time I've ever heard you admit that you didn't do something well. because normally it's like, oh, you know, she likes to paint. I'm the best artist, or I'm, you know, the most successful. And it extends to her kids. It's like, my husband got a raise once. Excuse me. It was a promotion. And she said, so when are you going to be CEO? He's like, I have no interest in being CEO. I'm like, many stages away from the CEO. I have no interest for that. I like what I do. And she's like, but you of course have aspirations. It's like, no, not really. I don't want to be CEO. But it's like not good enough to just be good in your job and be satisfied with your job. It's like, always has to be, you have to be the best. You have to be the most important. Her daughter as well. It's like, oh, well, when are you going to be the manager? It's like, you don't always have to be the top person in the whatever group you're working. You can just do your own job really well and be content with that. But there's this desire to always be the best, and even when it's not necessarily wanted by that person or not necessarily an accurate representation of truth.
Are there other examples of this kind of behavior outside of ambitions in work and lifestyle choices?
I would say that those are probably the best examples that I can give. Some of the other personality traits are things like conversations have to surround about her. Any conversation about somebody else somehow ends up being about her. So that might play out as we might have a conversation about, we might be on the phone with my husband and his siblings about his father's doctor's appointment because he's got some health issues. And we're getting, you know, an update on how his doctor's appointment went. And somehow the conversation comes back to her. Oh, but while we were at the doctor's appointment, I asked the doctor about my stuff. And they're like, wait a second, we're trying to get an update on him, not you. But all the conversations come back to her. We'll be sitting around talking as a family and we'll be talking. They'll be asking questions about, you know, our kid. And somehow the conversation comes back to her. And I remember when I was a kid and da, 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 da. But it's not just like once or twice. It's all the time. So, you know, that can be rather grating.
And on a scale from 0 to 10, how much does this bother you / affect you on a daily basis?
Doesn't affect me on a daily basis. It affects me most when we are together. And that I would say it's 100% of the time when we're together.
How often are you together?
So not so much anymore. We used to live about an hour's drive away, and then we moved a flight away. So now anytime we're getting together, it's for longer periods of time, which comes with its own challenges. It's not just a few hours. It's a few days at a time. But thankfully, there's positives and negatives. But both my parents and my husband's parents live in the same general area. They live about an hour, 2 hours drive from one another. So whenever we're going to visit one, we go visit both. And we're ending up to spend a few days with one and a few days with the other, or they'll come here. So like they're coming Hanukkah, I think. And I'm already stressing about it because I had to set limits, like, you know, no more than this many days. And these are some things that we're going to have to talk about and whatever,
like what?
Saying this to my husband. So the last time they were here was last Pesach, and we all got COVID while they were here. It was 12 days of being trapped together because, of course, everybody didn't get sick all at the same time. It was like one and then the other and then the other. But nobody had any like really serious symptoms. It was just like at that time, mostly people were having mild symptoms, you know, runny noses and sore throats and whatnot. But it was, and everybody but her was pretty okay. And she was like lying on the couch, like, I can't do anything. Everybody take care of me. I can't walk. I can't get myself a drink. She was leaving her dirty tissues all over the place. It was just like, we're all sick too. Like, don't we're not interested in this. And after that visit, I was like, never again. 12 days is way too long. I don't want to see them in my house ever again. And I'm laughing about it, but it was a huge source of anxiety. Like I'm having to prepare with my therapist for this upcoming visit from 2 months in advance, or whatever, 6 weeks in advance.
Does your husband have the same reactions and experience that you do?
So it's interesting. Children of people who have narcissistic personality disorder or just narcissistic tendencies or behavior traits tend to develop from a very young age coping mechanisms, and they don't see what people who are first introduced to the person with those behaviors as an adult. Kind of like if somebody in your family does something strange or unusual or like has a weird quirk, you don't necessarily notice it if you're the person that has known them your entire life, but somebody else might notice it. Like, oh, wow, have you ever noticed how they, I don't know, bite their lip? And it's like, no, I never noticed, but somebody else might. So similarly, the child of someone who has narcissistic personality disorder will develop coping mechanisms to not see the things, or at least not be bothered by them. One of the things that I've had to do in order to make myself understood as to why things are so difficult for me is have conversations with my husband as to, like, you know, what are the things that are bothersome to me? How does it affect me? And just be very factual. Like, have you ever noticed how your mom won't do anything for herself when she's around other people, and even not around other people? I've never seen her clean. I've never seen her cook. I've never seen her manage finances ever. My father-in-law does everything. She stopped working well before they could afford for her to stop working. She doesn't want to do anything. And it's, you know, almost like it's beneath her, but he doesn't recognize that that's related, that they're all, things are connected. He doesn't pick up on the fact that some of her behaviors are rude to other people, or that she is very often very inconsiderate to other people. For example, 8 weeks after I had my son, I was back in the hospital with postpartum depression, and she was calling regularly. She was calling my husband. I didn't have a phone, but she was calling my husband like several times a day. When can we next see the baby? I want to see the baby. How come you don't let me see the baby? And because I had just recently had a baby, they had my husband brought my son twice a day. I was nursing. So that was like the baby bonding time. I sent the milk that I had pumped during the day back with him. And she called during one of these visits. It was like the seventh or eighth time she had called that day. She was like, you're keeping the baby from me. You can't do this to me. I deserve to see the baby. I grabbed the phone from him and I said, listen, I'm in the hospital. You need to leave us alone. It's not a good time. We'll let you know when it's a good time. And hung up. She couldn't take no, or we'll let you know when it's a good time, for my husband until I yelled at her and gave her some kind of explanation. And maybe the call stopped for 24 hours. But it didn't matter to her that we needed space. We were going through something as a family, because her desire to see the baby was more important. That was an experience that really helped him understand, like, you know, okay, this is not normal.
And has she been diagnosed?
She's been diagnosed by psychiatrists that I know. I can't say that she's officially been diagnosed. She will never go see a psychiatrist. She won't go to therapy. Her family members have encouraged it, because she has very, very high levels of anxiety. She self-medicates. She'll go to one doctor and say, oh, I am having anxiety. And the doctor will give her a prescription. She'll go to another doctor who will give her a prescription. She takes whatever she wants. She doesn't take whatever she doesn't want. You know, that's ended her up in the hospital a few times because she doesn't take things as prescribed. She just went into the hospital 2 weeks ago with crazy high blood pressure because she decided she doesn't need to take her blood pressure medications. And I said to my sister-in-law and my husband, like, this is how she keeps the attention on herself, by not following her doctor's recommendations, she's guaranteeing that she will continue to be sick. It's just another way to keep the attention, the focus on her.
Since you have enlightened your husband of his mother's ways, has he been more helpful and supportive?
Yeah, definitely. Part of that support was working with me to set boundaries to our relationship. And some of the things I said, like, hey, this is what I need. And some of the things we, you know, came to a resolution together. One of the things that I said to him, like, listen, this is just something I have to do, was leaving the family WhatsApp chat. His family has a WhatsApp chat, as so many of our families do. And the conversations were just getting on my nerves. They always came back to her. And it was just getting to be very overwhelming. So I just left. And I said, listen, I can't be part of this chat. Your family's nice. I still want to have a relationship with them, but it can't be in this WhatsApp chat. And he was like, okay, fine. When it came to things like when our son was very young and they wanted to get together all the time, every Sunday they wanted to get together. I'm like, listen, we both work full time. We can't just like drive, spend 2 hours driving and spend a few hours with you every single Sunday. Sunday is the only day that we have to go grocery shopping, to clean the house, like all these other things. And we just have things we want to do in our own lives. So establishing, coming together on what would be an appropriate amount of visits, let's say. So we arrived at once a month, we'll get together. 1 month you come to us, 1 month we'll go to you, by spending like 8 hour days just traveling to and from and visiting. And it was very exhausting and to the exclusion of everything else.
When you set those boundaries, did she accept it or did she fight it?
I don't remember. We're talking like 10 years ago, so I don't remember for sure.
Was moving away the primary reason you moved a flight away?
We moved for a bunch of reasons. Financial considerations was a big one. We were living in a place that was much more expensive to live than where we live currently. So that was, I'd say, the primary consideration. And the stress of the lifestyle there was also a big consideration. Maybe tertiary was family, because there's some nice things about living close to family also. So it wasn't all horrible, but it definitely was down the list consideration.
Are you close with your parents? And is your husband close with your parents?
I am. My husband is close to my parents and I'm close to my parents. I do have some siblings that live not far from me, like a drive away. And, you know, that's nice to have, you know, some family members close. We still see both sets of parents a couple times a year. Sometimes we go there, sometimes they come to us, but it's kind of difficult for us to go for holidays, which is something that my parents in particular would like to spend holidays together. But it's difficult because anything less than at least 50% of the time we're in, you know, the general area spent with my mother-in-law is not enough. I mean, we've had trips where we've been there for a week and we've spent 3 or 4 days with my in-laws. And the day we're leaving, she says, we never see you. We were just there for 3 days. What do you mean we never see you? There's a lot of guilt tripping on that.
And your parents pick up on this dynamic? You talk to them about that?
Oh, they're very well aware. They noticed things like when we were preparing for our wedding. And I remember asking my in-laws to be like, you know, give me the names of people that you want us to send invitations to. They only had 2 friends. And over time, I learned it's because nobody wants to be friends with my mother-in-law. They are friends for a few years and then they drop her. Even her own family members don't want to be around her. It's quite sad. And it's not because she's a shy person. She's very outgoing. People just aren't interested in having a relationship with her after a certain amount of time. They just stop talking to her.
Are there any nice moments that you can share that are purely nice or maybe 95%?
So I have to give her credit. When my father-in-law's father, my husband's grandfather, was not well enough to live on his own, he moved in with my in-laws and my mother-in-law took care of him. And I was really surprised and impressed at how much she devoted herself to taking him to his doctor's appointments and making sure that he had, you know, everything that he needed taken care of. It wasn't something that like was planned over time. It was kind of all of a sudden. I was really impressed by that. She can be a very caring person. I do not believe that she's malicious. I think this is something that she's developed due to unfortunate circumstances. Her parents got married, then she was conceived and her father was shipped off to Korea. She was born when her father was away. Her father was not able to come home until she was almost 2 years old. She and her mother have never had a good relationship. Her mother was very obviously not loving to her, which was not the case to her other siblings. There was a lot of tension and resentment throughout their lives. Her mother didn't want to see her when she was on her deathbed. It was really, really deep and really quite sad. I can't blame my mother-in-law for why she is the way she is. And at the same time, I can find the behaviors frustrating.
Do you know why she wasn't loved by her mother?
I think her mother resented the fact that she had to raise a newborn by herself while her husband was away. That's my own thought.
It reminds me of the episode we did on What If You Hate Your Kids with Gelia Sofsky. Okay, so did you start therapy because of this complicated relationship, or were there other things like postpartum depression? I'm curious what started first.
I have bipolar disorder. So I've been treated by psychiatrists and in therapy before I even met my husband. And mental health care has been something that's incredibly important to me. The postpartum depression was something that I dealt with as a result of having a prior diagnosis. We knew what was eventually going to happen. It was just a matter of how serious, at what point, how severe would it be? So the psychiatrists I've spoken to about my mother-in-law are my own psychiatrists. And I said, like, hey, how am I supposed to deal with this? And that was when I learned about narcissistic personality disorder. And learning about it more has helped me be able to, first of all, recognize behaviors and not just say, like, oh my gosh, that's something that is a clinical determinant of narcissistic personality disorder, and not just think, oh my God, that's so annoying. Like, this is such an annoying trait. But when you're able to, at least for me, when I was able to attach it, say like, oh, this can be annoying, and it can also be something that she does because of this condition, even though she's never been formally diagnosed in conversations that I've had with my psychiatrists. I'm also in therapy just because that's how I maintain regularity. It's how I've dealt over the years with lots of things that come up in my life. And thankfully, I'm in a really great place. Spending some of the time in my therapy sessions to help work through familial situations, including situations that come up with my mother-in-law, have proven to be very effective tools because we don't exist in a vacuum. We are... Our whole entire life impacts our own mental health. So when I am able to bounce ideas off of my therapist and say like, okay, how can I better deal with this situation or things of that nature? It's been able to not only help me deal with the situation, but also not obsess over it, stress over it, and let it, you know, affect me negatively.
Can you give some examples?
Some of the things that are just kind of at the top of my mind right now are how to deal with visits, thinking about this upcoming visit. So whether we are going to my in-laws or they're coming to us, I have to like plan in advance how I am going to deal with the situations that very commonly come up, because it's not the first time that we're getting together. I have all these years of exposures that I can say, okay, this situation's likely to come up, that situation's likely to come up. Some of the things are to make sure that I continue to take care of the things that I regularly need to do for myself. So just because they're visiting, I'm still going to go to the gym. I'm still going to get out of the house a few times a day because being stuck all together is very overwhelming to me. So that might be taking my dog for more walks. It might be going for coffee with a friend. It also would mean letting a few of my friends know that my in-laws are coming. And if I randomly show up at your house because I'm frustrated or just need to get out, that's why I'm there. And they'll be informed ahead of time that I may need to call on them for support. Limiting the amount of time that we visit or that they come here. This previous experience with Pesach showed us that 12 days was way too long. The limit is usually 4 to 5 days, and 5 is even pushing it. So for this upcoming trip that they're coming, it's 5 days, 4 days max, 5 if they need to leave in the morning of the 5th day, but absolutely no longer than that.
And how did the trip come about? They say, we want to come to you, and then what would work for you? And you presented these dates and they said, okay, or was there a negotiation?
They said, we want to come. To my husband. Then he came to me and he's like, my parents want to come. So I said, when? Actually, I said, when? I was really like, and he said, how about Hanukkah weekend? Because our son has off of school. I said, let me think about it. Thought about it for a day. I said, okay, here's the things that need to be adhered to. No more than 4 or 5 days. If day 5 is the travel day, and I expect to be treated well because I was treated like garbage the last time they came. And we talked about what some of those things are. They need to clean up after themselves. They need to respect my privacy. And not one time I was on the phone in my room because I just needed some away time and I couldn't go to many places because I had been exposed to COVID. So I was just in my room. I was reading. I was listening to music. I was on the phone. I don't remember exactly. My mother-in-law was like knocking on all the doors. Why? Where are you? Where are you? And so I said to my husband, this time around, I need my privacy. I need to be respected. I'm not going to deal with this again. You know, there were a few things that I delineated for him. And I said, under those conditions, then fine, that weekend is okay. When we're visiting them, we don't stay with them because that's too much for me to be around together all the time is just, there's no respite. So we stay whatever nearby. We usually get a hotel that's near their home for a couple nights and stay there because otherwise it's 24-hour togetherness and there's no break. And it gets really overwhelming for both of us, but for me in particular.
So every interaction is negative or parved?
Yeah, unfortunately.
And what's your son's relationship with your mother-in-law?
They talk on the phone a lot. I think they talk probably a good 2 or 3 times a week because my mother-in-law like just randomly calls him. They talk like before Shabbos. My son calls his grandparents before Shabbos, but she'll like randomly call in the evening. He'll be like, I have to do my homework. I want to go out with a friend. And I think he thinks it's a little bit strange. When he was little, he thought it was fun and cool. And now he's not so young anymore. He's a preteen. And he's like, why are you calling me?
How often does your husband speak with her?
A few times a day, most likely. I am not part of the conversations most of the time. And a lot of the conversations surround health issues that both of my in-laws are dealing with right now. So that is probably the biggest contributing factor to the frequency of the phone calls. And my mother-in-law is also very into politics, and there's no dearth of conversation starters these days. We have a rule that there's no politics conversation and also no religion conversation. I constantly have to remind my mother-in-law because my husband doesn't mind avoiding those topics, but my mother-in-law doesn't. And I've literally had to walk out of rooms or say, sorry, we're leaving, unless you change the conversation. And sometimes she respects that and sometimes she doesn't.
And do you ever speak with her? Do you ever call her or does she call you, or it's just via your husband?
It's very rare. As I mentioned, I work in healthcare. She'll randomly call me with questions about either her own things or her friends' things and be like, I'm not on their medical team. I can't possibly evaluate that. That's something that they need to talk about with their doctor. And then I'll get, you know, like multiple follow-up questions. Like, that's, you need to talk to your doctor about that. Your friend needs to talk to her doctor about that. And it can, like, a broken record over and over again. I'll send her a text once in a while, like for her birthday or something like that. But I very rarely initiate conversations. I'll get on the phone and say hi when other people are on the phone, but rarely have more than perfunctory conversations.
What about the shared load between siblings in your husband's family? Is there conversation with his siblings to make sure that they have everything they need or they're taken care of?
So he has one sibling who lives very close to his parents, and she helps with a lot of the day-to-day type stuff and being the eyes and then communicating that to my husband and myself. She is not in a position that she can leave work in the middle of the day and go to doctor's appointments, but she'll get the information about what was discussed, or she'll go to their parents after work and she'll call my husband and say, listen, Dad didn't look really good. This is what I saw. This is what I'm hearing him say. And I have this concern. And then my husband will call and say, like, okay, what's going on? And get another side of the story and try to figure out what's going on. My husband is responsible or plays a major role in their financials after they had some pretty significant financial issues. Then when they had changes in, my father-in-law had to stop working and they had to like figure out how they could budget, you know, with just Social Security and being on Medicare and all these kinds of things that are understandably very complicated. And to say that 60-something-year-olds can navigate this on their own, even in the best of health, is saying a bit much, but that's another conversation. So he was, you know, trying to help them with that kind of stuff. So he's involved a lot with, he and his sister both are involved with the medical stuff.
Are you the only one who's frustrated with the relationship?
No.
Or does everyone have something?
My husband doesn't see it as much as his sister. His sister has a background in psychology also. So she's very aware what these behaviors can be a sign of. My husband also has two half-siblings that are his father's kids from a previous marriage. I learned a lot from my sister-in-law, who is my husband's half-sister, about the family history and the background, because she was in their lives before my husband and his full sister. So it was like only about two, three years ago that I learned about the relationship between my mother-in-law and her mother and why it was so tenuous. Like, I knew that they sometimes didn't talk to each other, but I didn't understand how deeply it went. Then my husband's half-sister explained to me, and I was like, what? So the other siblings are definitely aware, and they deal with it differently. But my sister-in-law, my husband's full sister, is also in therapy because of her relationship with her mother, and it's had a toll on her life. My husband is more and more understanding why these behaviors are so difficult for people in the family to deal with. I think seeing the things that are coming up that are related to taking care of her own health and the financial issues that are coming up now, and like not being willing to either sell things and to live off some of that income or budget so that, you know, you're buying things that are a little bit cheaper or going out to eat less often because there's this like really strong, I have to have the best things. And he's seeing how that is getting in the way of her being able to be a completely healthy individual.
That's direct proof of how it's not functioning.
Yeah. You know, when we think about what is a pathology, it's something that gets in the way of being able to function in a normal way on a day-to-day basis. There's so many of these behaviors that do get in the way of everyday life.
Do you have anything else in your notes that you wanted to share?
So I think I already said, like, it can be very, very difficult to deal with an in-law parent who has narcissistic behaviors, whether it's narcissistic personality disorder or just the behaviors, but it's not impossible. And for me, one of the most significant things that has helped me manage it is therapy for myself. And I would say that is something that anybody, whether or not you feel yourself and you have any kind of mental health issues, if the relationship is difficult for you to manage, then therapy is an option. And it doesn't have to be ongoing forever. It can be a few sessions, help me get some tools in my toolkit for how to deal with scenarios, but a competent therapist can be really, really helpful.
I want to thank you for coming on and to talk about this complicated dynamic in your family. What are you getting out of you sharing this on a podcast? Is it just to spread awareness? Is it merely because I asked for it? Or do you actually get some satisfaction from sharing your story?
It's a little bit cathartic to be able to talk about it with somebody besides my therapist and my family members. Being able to share that with another person, other people, gives me some relief. I will be very honest about that. I'd say most importantly, if my experiences, which have been over the past 15 or so years, and many have been very trying, if somebody could find something useful in that, it would be, I wouldn't say make everything go away, but it would be worth it that somebody could get some benefit and either to become aware that certain behaviors are, ultimately, it's not the person's fault. They have a condition. They don't know how to deal with it. And unless somebody who has narcissistic behaviors is going to go get help, then it's not going to change. And two things can be true at once. It can be frustrating to deal with, and it can be, this is just the way they are. If the person that who presents with these behaviors isn't going to go get help, then the people around them can go get help. And being aware that these behaviors are a sign of a narcissistic problem, then go get the help yourself. And if people can recognize that and understand that, it can help them not only cope with this individual that is in their life, but also help them have more peace when they do have to interact with that person in their life.
Thank you, Miriam, so much.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you for listening until the end. I hope you enjoyed this episode. I hope you benefited from this episode. If you did, please share it with a friend or a few friends. Please review this podcast on your podcast streaming app. This is a Jewish Coffee House podcast, so make sure to check out the other podcasts on the network, including Intimate Judaism, Orthodox Conundrum, and Chochmah Nashim. See you next time.